If you drive across Route 80 through the northern part of the state, you do not see anything resembling what you see when you come from Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. And those are the two that are most predominantly the Democratic areas. It is often joked that the middle is Alabama. According to the map in 1972, it was roughly a rectangle with a little knob sticking off one end. It spreads from Chester County up almost to Bloomsburg, which is a pretty broad area that would not be very similar in many ways.
Cindy Blair Miller is 66 years old and has lived in Downingtown, Pennsylvania, west of Philadelphia, for nearly 40 years. Historically, the area votes Republican. Cindy is a Democrat.
In 1982, it did not encompass me, so I wasn't even in the district at that point.
I'm just going to recite the
Gettysburg Address or something.
You know it?
87 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal.
All right.
Do you want me to go on?
Cindy is sitting on the couch in her living room, clicking through an online map of the 6th Congressional District where she lives.
So you're just going to stand there and hold that?
Yeah.
Okay.
The map changes every 10 years after the census, just like it's supposed to. But some years, those changes are drastic.
So by 92, let's see if you're back in.
Yes. The shape is now, looks like somebody stuck a long skinny strip on the back end of it. And I'm just barely in the district. Wait a minute. I'm not in the district here either.
2002 was a big year, and this is... It's starting to resemble a little bit more of what we have today.
Yeah, and it's a very, if you look at it clearly, it's a very strange shape. It goes around big chunks. I mean, it leaves out the King of Prussia area and the 422 corridor, but it wraps around it, and then it does sort of the same thing. It does a branch off to go into a northern piece all the way up to Route 78.
But it's not just the borders of that map that are changing. By 2011, the constituents, the people represented within those boundaries, are completely different.
If you really look at it closely, they've literally just sort of left this little circle out of the picture and cut out the entire city of Reading. It's not a huge city by any means, but it has had a lot of years of not doing so well. So I imagine they left them out for political purpose. That's all I can assume. I look at that map and I think somebody must have been on drugs or something when they drew it. I mean, how can you logically say that makes sense? We'll draw a map and we'll leave out this little piece here. If you look at the 7th Congressional District, it's even worse. That isn't logical.
The truth is, it's completely logical. It's true, the shape of Pennsylvania's 7th District, or the 6th, looks haphazard and aimless. But as soon as you realize why they look that way, as soon as you realize the plan behind the chaos, the cold, hard logic becomes clear. What's illogical to Cindy Blair Miller actually made a whole lot of sense to a group of strategists 8 years ago. Now, after all that redistricting and redrawing, Cindy has the feeling she's been had. That powerful people have stolen her vote.
The basis of all this is elections are supposed to be free and fair. And free is not going to be addressed by this, but whether it's fair in terms that it accurately represents the population and their perspectives. And if you design a congressional map that specifically divides it up so that you focus the district on a particular party, then you're not representing the people accurately. And that doesn't seem fair.
What to do about it? Well, that's less clear.
I have big questions about what's the right way to district. How do you look at the map and go, here's how we can break it up into logical components and determine congressional representation realistically?
That's the question we're here to answer today. When people use the system to undermine your vote, what's the right way to fix it? What's the right way to draw a district? It's a question that Pennsylvania is wrestling with right now, and it's a question before a handful of other states, and even to some degree, the Supreme Court, as the justices consider fair metrics for judging congressional lines. What's a fair and legal way to draw the districts, and what's not? This is Drawn Out. The Value of a Vote from Pennsylvania to the Supreme Court, a special podcast from The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and on this episode, we'll explore what's happening with power and leverage in Pennsylvania as it fights a redistricting battle while the nation watches.
My representative picked me. I didn't pick my representative.
We'll explain how some of our most contorted congressional maps came to be.
With Red Map, Republicans pulled off perhaps the biggest and most inexpensive political heist in American political history.
And how technology is driving what these maps will look like and how they'll function in the future.
If I produce 1,000 maps randomly on the computer that are just as good as your map on all the neutral criteria, and then let's see how these maps compare to yours.
And listen, if you started to glaze over or doze off when you heard redistricting or congressional map, then I'm here to tell you that that moment you decided this kind of backroom power brokering couldn't possibly matter to you, that's the moment some very patient and very, very smart political operators stole your vote. It was right there in the politics of technicality and precinct analysis that the people who cared enough to do it and to do it right were able to steal your vote before you even cast it. Cindy Blair Miller from her home in the 6th District of Pennsylvania, she believes her vote matters the way most Americans do.
Absolutely. I mean, I would like it to matter more, but everybody's vote matters. And that's why it bugs me people don't vote. I would venture to say a lot of people probably figure their vote doesn't matter. It's not worth it.
That's the American democratic ideal, right? Everyone should vote because every vote counts. But in reality, the people who really look at these maps and understand how they came to be, they know that's not true.
Hi, my name is David Daly. I am the author of Rat Fucked, Why Your Vote Doesn't Count.
David Daly is one of the nation's leading experts on redistricting and gerrymandering. He's devoted an entire book with a pretty intense name to the power behind these processes that most Americans don't pay a lot of attention to. And to be clear, not all redistricting is gerrymandering.
A redistricting is the process every 10 years of redrawing state legislative and congressional lines to account for population changes. It's done after the census.
Gerrymandering? It's like redistricting's evil twin.
Gerrymandering really is the dark art of drawing lines that advantage your side and that whack the other side in the kneecap. It's actually very ironic. In theory, we actually redraw all of these districts every 10 years in order to make them more fair. In a series of landmark cases of the 1960s, the Supreme Court found under the 14th Amendment the idea of equal protection under the law and one person, one vote, that districts had to be equal in size in order for our votes to actually all be equal. So it's a sense of fairness and a fair play that drives this. But in the hands of politicians, especially in the hands of politicians given such specific voter information and the ability to draw lines that can't lose, it's become a means for partisans to hijack democracy.
When those partisans use the gerrymander to hijack democracy, it usually happens in one of two ways.
There's cracking and there's packing. When you pack, the goal is to cram as many of the other side's voters as you can into as few seats as possible. And when you crack them, the goal is to spread them across as many districts as you can and dilute their voice and ability to elect a member of their choosing.
The truth is, none of this is new. Partisans have been using gerrymandering to their advantage for hundreds of years. But over the last decade, one party cracked the code on how to make the strategy work in their favor in a lasting way and at a pretty low cost.
In 2010, something changes. These gerrymanders right now are so technologically driven, they're so data-driven, they're so specific and precise and surgical that they're able to withstand waves and endure for a decade, whereas in the past, that simply wasn't possible. People would move, politics would change, and the lines would ultimately get swamped.
The party that pulled it off? Republicans.
We live in a deeply divided 50-50 country, and yet Republicans hold essentially all of the political power, not only in Washington, but in state legislature after state legislature. And to be rat-fucked, really, is to have your vote not have the same value that it would if you lived in a district that was actually fairly drawn. What has happened to our politics is it's been driven more extreme, it's been driven more divisive, and it's been completely cut off from the ballot box. Our politicians have become completely insulated from us, and it's because they came up with a masterful scheme really to reinvent the gerrymander in a very audacious and modern and technologically savvy new way, and so much of it starts right here in Pennsylvania.
And in Pennsylvania, a lot of people have woken up to what's been going on.
I think the people of Pennsylvania understand that they have been rat-fucked.
Smooth in that outfit. Last night, the Flyers beat the Canadians 5-3. 76ers face the Pelicans tonight.
My name is Beth Lawn, and I live in Chester, Pennsylvania, in District 7, the famous, infamous, whatever, District 7.
27 degrees now at 807.
We are now at the intersection of East 24th Street and Providence Road, a block and a half from my house, and we are about to leave District 7. And cross into District 1. As soon as the light changes here, we will be on our way. Here we are. I don't know if the line's in the middle of the street or on the other side, but here we are now in District 1.
Does it feel different?
Just feels exactly the same. Doesn't feel a bit different at all. This is really crazy. Anyway, so for several more blocks now, we will be in District 1. Currently Bob Brady's district. Okay, here is Parkway. We're about to leave here, Gray Street. We have now left District 7, or District 1. We passed through District 1. Now we have left District 1, and we're back in District 7 on the way to my son Greg's house.
How long was that? 2 minutes?
About 2.5, 3 minutes. Mm-hmm.
The district where Beth lives is infamous in the annals of twisted, gnarled congressional maps. One time, the Washington Post even had a contest making fun of the Rorschach test of staring at congressional maps for too long. The contestant who won said the Pennsylvania 7th looks like Goofy kicking Donald Duck. And honestly, it pretty much does.
Well, basically, after the census, states must perform a redistricting process. My name is Terry Madonna. I'm the director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall College in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Of course, reapportionment has to take place. That means if you're talking about Congress, the federal government has to decide based on the population how many members of Congress each state gets. Then each state, usually in its constitution, gets to decide how those congressional districts will get drawn. Some states have the state legislature do it in the form of a bill. Some states have commissions to essentially do the redistricting in that way. So there's a variety of practices out there. Pennsylvania uses the state law. The legislature passes a state law. The governor gets to say yes or no. And of course, then it's subject to legal challenge, which is not uncommon.
It's not uncommon. In fact, the courts are now rife with lawsuits challenging voting maps all over the country. A couple have gone all the way to the Supreme Court. More on that in a bit. But here in Pennsylvania, the whole thing has turned into an epic saga between plaintiffs, Republicans, the governor, and the state Supreme Court. Years after the map was approved, now there are urgent deadlines to get rid of it. Some Republicans even want the Supreme Court justices in Pennsylvania impeached because they struck down the map. So how exactly did Pennsylvania get here?
Well, the current map was drawn in 2011 by a legislature controlled by Republicans, passed in the form of a bill signed into law by a Republican governor in our state, Governor Tom Corbett. And that became the basis on which members of Congress were elected beginning in 2012.
But former Governor Tom Corbett, who took office in January of 2011, insists there was no discussion of 2012 elections or maximizing Republican power in Pennsylvania for a decade to come.
We didn't talk that way at all. the legislature passed a bill. They sent it to me. If they talked the politics of it, which I would expect they would, because this is a political process from day one. And anybody who wants to take all the politics out of it is, you know, you're not going to be able to do it. And when it was presented to us, again, we took a look to see if it met prior Supreme Court cases. And I don't have the name of the Supreme Court case in front of me, but I believe we thought, yes, it met the prior decision of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court and of the United States Supreme Court. And at that point in time, they recommended that I sign it.
It was gerrymandered to a fare-to-well. I mean, Pennsylvania suburbs outside of Philadelphia, the burbs as we call them here, were heavily gerrymandered to favor the Republicans. And you can go through the state and find a couple of seats here and there that similarly were gerrymandered, meaning putting boundary lines in and around counties and even dividing up local governments. So literally, you could drive down a road within a municipality, and on one side of the road, you'd be in one congressional district, and on another side of the road, you'd be in yet a different congressional district. So you begin to see the point. It took three elections to dramatically see the impact, if you will, of the gerrymandering.
Of course, not everyone sees partisan gerrymandering when they gaze at the Pennsylvania map. Drew Crompton is the top attorney representing Republicans in the state Senate. He's also chief of staff to the Senate president, Joe Scarnati. And Drew was there back in 2011 when the current map was drawn.
I know that certain areas of the Commonwealth are likely to vote for Democrats. And I think I'll know that certain areas of the Commonwealth will likely pick a Republican. But that's just the geographical and the demographic balance we have across the Commonwealth. We don't have a state that's sprinkled R and D evenly from Ohio border to the New Jersey border. That's not what people look like when you cross 300 miles of our Commonwealth. I think it was a perfectly constitutional map. That doesn't mean it's necessarily a pretty map. It doesn't mean it's necessarily the way somebody else would draw it. But, you know, people lose sight of the fact that over 30 Democrats in the House, when we passed it in 2011, voted for it. They made political calculations of their own on casting a yes vote. It was a give and take through the process.
The Republican-controlled Pennsylvania legislature approved the map in 2011, and in the House, 36 Democrats voted for it. But outside the marble halls of the state Capitol building in Harrisburg, most people just didn't know what was going on, that the districts around them were changing, and that power was shifting quietly and drastically.
Overall, there was not what I would call a lot of interest. You know, what goes on in the process, unless organizations actively get engaged and get the public engaged, the process of drawing boundary lines is pretty much internal, in this case, to the state legislature.
Looking back now, a lot of people say all this was deliberately hidden. The first chance for most voters to realize something might be different came during the 2012 election. Here's Beth Lawn again. Remember, she lives in the city of Chester, and in 2010, her home was in District 1, a heavily Democratic district centered on Philadelphia.
I had an inkling that something happened in the 2012 election when Bob Brady wasn't on the ballot anymore.
Bob Brady is the longtime congressman from District 1, and he was on the ballot in 2012. Just not on Beth's ballot. Bob Brady didn't go anywhere. Beth did. What she didn't realize was that during the redistricting of 2011, she was moved to District 7.
The first thing I did was talk to my son about it. So he Googled District 7, and we started looking at this crazy map and just saying, how did this happen? You know, it was just stunning. I don't know what other word to use, but just say stunning to look at that map and think, this is the district that we live in. This is how it's configured. And this is what happened. They took me out of District 1, cut me off from the rest of the city of Chester, my neighborhood, and a few other streets.
What was going on? Beth didn't really know what it was, but she had a pretty good idea what it wasn't. It didn't feel like democracy. And she started looking to get involved.
Marty Moskowain was interviewing Ben Geffen from the Public Interest Law Center one morning, and I was listening to it, and he started talking about this case that was being put together challenging the gerrymandering in Pennsylvania under the state constitution. And I was at the point where I was really mad at that point. I mean, I was angry about this, and I had been looking for something to do, someplace to channel that you know, that emotion, that anger, and to do something to try to make a difference. And lots of things were being presented to me. There are always lots of things. I'm a Quaker, by the way, and Quakers in this area are very much activists. So I was always being asked to do things, but I didn't know which one to do. I'm also a religious person, as you know. I'm a chaplain. And so I prayed about it, and I asked for guidance. And when I heard Ben on the radio and he talked about this lawsuit, I said, this is it. This is something I need to get involved in. So I looked up his phone number, called him up, said, I heard about the lawsuit. If you want a plaintiff from District 7, I volunteer.
And Beth wasn't the only one. 17 other voters, one from each of Pennsylvania's 18 congressional districts, signed on, along with the League of Women Voters.
In June of last year, the League of Women Voters and citizens of the state filed a lawsuit claiming that the 2011 congressional maps, the gerrymandering, violated the Pennsylvania Constitution. That case eventually wound up in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and the court issued a per curiam order on January 22nd. The court's order laid out in a time frame a series of requirements for various elements of state government to meet, with the understanding that if it wasn't done by the time frame set by the court, the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania was quite prepared to prepare and/or adopt a map. And that's what literally the Supreme Court said: if you don't do it by a certain date and we don't have a map or maps to consider, then the ball will be in our hands.
That date was February 9th, 3 weeks after the state Supreme Court found the congressional maps unconstitutional, but the court didn't issue its full opinion until February 7th, and that backed Republicans up against a wall, just 2 days to produce a new map and send it to the governor.
I think the timeline is wholly unrealistic and unreasonable, and I don't have any similar analogies to another issue where a court has demanded that we take action in 16 days, let alone what really turned out to be 2 days.
Partisan gerrymander last month. From member station WESA, Anli Herring has more.
The Republican-controlled legislature...
Producers Ellen Frankman and Amber Hall drove to Harrisburg on deadline day, and that's where they met Drew Crompton. You remember him, the top attorney representing Senate Republicans. It was late on Friday afternoon, and with such a huge fight going on, with so much power at stake, you'd expect the halls to be packed with frenzied staffers and jostling reporters. But they weren't. Just like when the maps were drawn back in 2011, really, no one was around. The halls were quiet, and Drew was there, ready to get to work.
The ball is in our court, but in about an hour or 2 hours or 3 hours from now, we are going to release that ball and put it in the Supreme Court court and also in the executive branch's court. So then we become bystanders. Then we will see what other parties want to do, other branches of government want to do, and we will surrender our ball and see what the next play is.
Republicans managed to send their new map to the court on time, but it didn't really mean much. No one was surprised a few days later, on Tuesday, when Governor Wolf announced that his team had analyzed the map. The result? Still gerrymandered. And the map? Rejected. And the clock keeps on ticking.
Nothing is to prevent the governor, who already has experts that he's been consulting. They can send their own map on to the Supreme Court. Nothing is to prevent them from doing this. The Supreme Court can look at it or not look at it, use it or not use it. And conversely, there's nothing that would prevent legislative leaders from sending their map directly on, with or without going through the legislative process, or call the legislature into session, try to get the map adopted, and then send it on to the Supreme Court. The plaintiffs in the case have a map. You know, the Supreme Court has indicated within a relatively short time frame, I think it's February 19, they're supposed to say, here's a map, here's the new boundary lines. Now, trust me, this is all going to end up back in court, in the federal court. I can't believe that Republicans in the legislature aren't going to go ahead and file, you know, another suit.
So another lawsuit is basically a guarantee. Here's Drew Crompton again.
We're not forgoing any potential litigation down the road, depending on how this plays out. We're trying to participate in good faith. over our objections of both the decision and the order, but we also understand that at some point, if the state Supreme Court elects to draw a map, we will likely engage in further litigation strategy.
Turns out the story of how Pennsylvania maps came to be and the power grab they represent is the story you could tell for maps all across the country, all around the same time, all after one big election.
2008 is a huge year for the Democratic Party.
Tonight is your answer. It's the answer told by lines that stretched around schools and churches in numbers this nation has never seen.
Republicans got absolutely smoked. The country elects Barack Obama, a Democratic supermajority to the U.S. Senate, and also a Democratic majority in the U.S. House. Republicans looked around the country. They saw themselves on the wrong end of a time bomb.
Did this, and where does this lead
the
Republican
the
Party?
Do you know?
The head of the RNC.
Yeah, Republican right National
now.
Committee.
Right now.
I don't know. You don't know. Nobody knows. There's your answer, Diane. Nobody knows. It could be a guy named Ziggy. We don't know who it is. There's no leadership, okay?
They needed a plan.
And then an idea popped into the head of one sandy-haired Republican strategist. Chris Jankowski had the plan Republicans needed. He called it REDMAP, and even the name was a kind of elegant genius. REDMAP stands for the Redistricting Majority Project, and also clearly states what it intended to do to America's electoral map: turn it red.
One day, in 2009, a very smart operative named Chris Jankowski, who works for something called the Republican State Leadership Committee, is reading a story in the New York Times about the 2010 census and about the importance of a handful of governor's races in 2010, because those governors controlled a redistricting and had veto power over the maps that were going to be delivered after the upcoming census. And a light bulb goes off over Jankowski's head. He has worked in state government all of his life. He understands that in many ways it's the best and the most inexpensive way to drive conservative policy. And what Jankowski and the Republicans realize is that the biggest bargain in American politics is down ballot. That if they can talk their donors not into running these really expensive races for the White House or the U.S. Senate, if they can talk them into understanding the importance of state house races in small towns across America, that they can use these big down ballot victories in otherwise forgotten races to actually draw themselves control of Congress. And Karl Rove writes an amazing op-ed in the Wall Street Journal in March of 2010. And really, he lays out the entire plan. The Democrats simply didn't get their newspaper that day.
He who controls redistricting can control Congress. That's what the subhead of Karl Rove's plan said. And he was right. In 2010, the 107 victories in these very targeted state legislative seats gave Republicans just as much control as they needed, exactly where they needed it. They got a free hand to draw huge congressional majorities, even in states like Pennsylvania that are pretty evenly split. And even the people with the most to lose from Red Map, the Democrats, didn't even notice.
The Democrats never saw this coming. It's not even that the Democrats lacked the creative imagination to come up with this plan on their own, but they weren't even able to play defense in these 107 state legislative races, some of which Karl Rove lays out explicitly in this piece. He tells them where they're going to show up. So in many ways, it's just political incompetence on an amazingly high order.
That includes Democrats who watched power slip away in Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania is the perfect ground zero for this because control of the state legislature as you head into the 2010 election is razor thin. 102 Democrats, 101 Republicans. Jankowski and his colleagues zero in on 20 Democratic seats. And over the course of the summer of 2010, they are looking and searching and trying to identify which ones they ought to focus on and what issues they might use. And as they're doing their polling and their focus grouping, they hit on an idea. one of the really effective messages they find is if they use what they call the Arlen Specter Library in ads.
It's been a great privilege to serve the people of Pennsylvania.
Now, Arlen Specter was a veteran, a U.S. senator from the state of Pennsylvania. He had been a Republican for many years. He's changed parties to the Democrats by this point. He is not the most popular figure in the state. He is about to be out of office, and his papers need a home. So the Republicans set up an amazing mailer, and they say all of these local representatives voted $600 million for the Taj Mahal Arlen Specter Library. And they send these ads out, and it just goes off the charts. You have to remember, 2010 is the summer of the Tea Party. It's the summer of all of this populist anger and frustration in American politics. And the idea that politicians are giving money in the middle of a recession to a library to, you know, essentially lionize another politician who they don't even really like all that much is incredibly outrageous to voters in Pennsylvania. One of the state legislators, a man named David Levdansky, who represents essentially a Reagan Democrat district outside of Pittsburgh, it tells me that he drove home and every day for 3 weeks he opened up his mailbox and there was another ad, another hit piece saying he had voted hundreds of millions of dollars to build a mausoleum essentially to the memory of Arlen Specter. The problem is this wasn't true. There was about $1 or $2 million that was tucked inside a $600 million capital budget for the entire state that would have gone to the Specter Library. But that didn't matter.
David Levdansky lost that 2010 race by 150 votes. Republicans took control of the state house, the Senate, and Republican Tom Corbett was elected governor. Republicans now had the power to redraw the congressional map all on their own. Red map had been realized, and the impact was immediate.
So in 2012, the first election that's held on these new maps, Democratic candidates for the state house get more votes. Republicans, however, take the chamber. Democratic candidates for the U.S. Congress get 100,000 more votes almost than Republican candidates. And yet, Republicans take 13 of the 18 seats. So Democrats, in a year that Barack Obama gets 52% of the vote in Pennsylvania, in a year in which Democratic U.S. House candidates get 51% of the vote, Democrats take just 28% of the actual seats. That's the power of district lines.
If you ask officials involved at the time about the red map plan, they say they didn't know anything about it. Not the strategy, not the game plan, not even the people involved. Remember Drew Crompton, the general counsel to Senate Republicans and top aide to State Senate President Joe Scarnati? He was there in 2010.
Joe Scarnati, who participated in the map drawing in 2011, never had one conversation with anybody in D.C. under Red Map or any of those other affiliates to draw these maps. We didn't work with them. We didn't know anything about them. They didn't pay our legal bills. I mean, the bottom line is we have no affiliation with them. And so if there was an effort, God bless it. But when we were subject to subpoenas and litigation and discovery to turn over documents, we had absolutely no interaction whatsoever with any D.C.-affiliated red map or anything along those lines.
Governor Tom Corbett was elected that fall.
2010, I was in my election. So that's all I followed. I did not follow any national red map or any state red map. To me, when you are running for office and you're part of a party, you want to win every seat. Now, you know you're not going to win every seat, but you also want to try and get the majority. I had a majority and still had difficulty. So, you know, in regard to the red map, it was not even on my radar scope.
David Daley doesn't buy that Pennsylvania Republicans like Corbett and Crompton didn't know about red map. But the thing is, in a way, it makes no difference. All Jankowski and Redmap had to do was appeal to voters on the local level and secure a majority for Republicans in the state house. After that, it was obvious Republicans would know exactly what to do with the census in hand and their new power at their fingertips. That kind of power is infectious. Maryland's governor, along with Democrats in the state assembly, redrew one district in 2011 and carved one Republican right out of his seat. That case is now before the U.S. Supreme Court.
This case is called Benisek versus Lamone, and it has to do with the especially egregious and invidious nature of the Democratic gerrymander there in Maryland that turned the 6th district from a solid Republican one into one that elects a Democrat fairly easily. In this case, the plaintiff's argument is that your rights of political association are violated when districts are drawn in such a partisan way as to penalize you for your beliefs.
If you're wondering how these maps get made in the first place, like actually drawn, today there's computer technology and sophisticated programs like Maptitude that are designed to draw districts, but still rely on the individual, usually a partisan individual, to complete the picture.
These partisan map makers have access to the kind of information that no one has ever had before when tasked with the job of drawing these districts. So a program like Maptitude, which is what most state legislatures use to go ahead and draw these maps, it comes preloaded with all of the census data on it. So that's already a pretty serious wealth of information about economics and class and ethnicity and religion and more. So then they are able to upload into that all of the public record databases that have come online in recent years. So what kind of cars do you own? What year have you voted? What years have you not voted? You can then cross-tabulate that against the precinct-level voting results down ballot in race after race. And then you can also add into this equation a cloud's worth of consumer preferences, social media searches by zip code, magazine subscriptions. You can create these truly powerful indexes by which you have a sense, block by block, exactly how these precincts are likely to vote. The Pennsylvania case revealed a little bit of information about just how specific some of these maps can be. And they had these indexes designed to go from Democratic to Republican, and their scale went from something like negative 1,900 on the Democratic side all the way to 2,400 on the Republican side. So they had 4,500 different degrees of partisan intensity that they were measuring as they tried to put together maps that would yield an enduring partisan advantage.
And the consequences of these razor-sharp district lines, more than 370 out of 435 U.S. House members are now running in districts that analysts consider high-confidence outcomes. In the real world, that means the incumbent is probably going to win. But it's about a lot more than just getting reelected.
You do have to wonder where you see 80, 90% turnout for a single candidate. Why would anybody need a district that safe? How does that serve the people who are represented? Because ultimately, why we care about these issues is because all of this undermines quality of representation. All of this undermines the ability of individuals to be heard.
Keisha Gaskins-Nathan is director of the Democratic Practice Program for the United States at the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, a public charity.
How many teachers are in their schools? What does it mean? How many cops in the street? How well are the cops on the street trained? How often the garbage is picked up? What is their tax rates? All these things that people care about, they're not heard. And if I know I can be reelected at a rate of 80%, who am I more likely to listen to? Am I more likely to listen to a lobbyist that shows up in my office or the person on the street? Where do my incentives lie? And that is one of the issues with all of this, is does it skew the incentives for our elected representatives in such a way that they are less likely to listen to the people who elected them?
David Daley says these skewed incentives played out in a big way in 2010 in North Carolina.
When Republicans went to remap North Carolina, they were determined to draw a 10-3 map, 10 Republicans and 3 Democrats. But the way that they figured out how to do this was by taking the very liberal, funky, vegan college town of Asheville out in the western mountain part of the state, and they cracked it in half, and they took half of the Democrats in that district and divided them into the 10th district and half and divided them into the 11th. And this new district that they created, a district that had been represented by a conservative Democrat, a district that had been a swing district that had gone back and forth, now elects Mark Meadows.
You are here and I am here because we indeed believe in America.
He wins this new district with upwards of 60% of the vote. It's Meadows who files the motion of no confidence in the chair that leads to the resignation of John Boehner as Speaker of the House. It is Meadows for whom Trump care is not conservative enough, and he holds it back until they're able to make it appropriately conservative to please his base. It's Meadows who is in charge, essentially, of driving the government shutdown in 2013 and plays a big part in the recent ones. These districts send a different kind of person to Washington, and when they get there, they are incentivized to behave in ways that don't make sense as far as actually governing. And Republicans really unleashed a Frankenstein's monster on themselves here. They created an enduring caucus majority, but they also created a caucus that they cannot control. And that has put the base in charge of our politics. I think in many ways it helped unleash the kinds of anger that led to Donald Trump. Certainly it created the kinds of conditions under which someone like Donald Trump could step into the Republican Party, sweep up the pieces, and get elected president.
It's alive! It's alive! It's alive!
A Frankenstein's monster, David Daley calls it. Do most Republicans see it that way? A few Republicans have sounded the alarm about their party being a captive of the base, people like Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona and Republican political scientist Norm Ornstein. But overall, it's safe to say most are fine with it. And that's not a value judgment on Republican policies. That's just the way partisan advantage works. If your side's winning, why complain? Now that gerrymandering is being challenged all across the country, the question is what to do about it. Not how to repeat the process for the other party, but how to come up with ways to avoid the power grab of partisan gerrymandering and make the whole process more democratic. Small d. Here's Keisha Gaskins Nathan again.
We see all kinds of different solutions. Some can be as simple as pulling this process out of the darkness, pushing it into the light. Because remember, like most of the redistricting is done at the school board level, county level, whereas a lot of this stuff seems very like esoteric to people. Start talking to people about where their school board lines are, and it becomes very real to people very quickly. Then there are big structural changes around who does the redistricting, taking it out of the hands of the people who are, benefit from it the most. But there's different types of ways. You have the California Citizen Commission that seems to be performing well. The process by which citizens are chosen is super complicated. They're a huge state. It requires an enormous amount of commitment. There is something like Florida, where Florida left it in the hands of the legislature, but deeply constrained the legislature from what it could consider, right? So the Florida legislature is no longer permitted to consider partisan lines, no longer allowed to benefit or harm any party or any incumbent. What's the problem? They do it anyway, and you have to sue. Mm. And so it ends up back in that partisan gerrymandering game where they do what they want to do, then you say they did it wrong, then you sue them, then you're thrown back into this mess.
So Pennsylvania's not alone in this mess. By Monday, the state Supreme Court will probably be the ones to decide on a new map if warring Republicans and Democrats can't agree on one on their own in Pennsylvania. Also, this term, the U.S. Supreme Court is busy with redistricting cases of its own. Wisconsin is the big one, challenging the state's 2011 redistricting plan drawn by ruling Republicans. There's the Maryland case David described earlier, one of the few instances of a gerrymander from Democrats that followed the 2010 census. And there's North Carolina, which the Supreme Court will probably send back to the district court once Wisconsin and Maryland are decided.
The biggest question of all is whether the Supreme Court wants to find a standard on when a partisan gerrymander has gone too far.
Daly says the justices aren't trying to solve gerrymandering or redraw districts here. They're trying to answer the question, how do you define a map that's gerrymandered and one that isn't? How can you tell?
The Supreme Court has never in the history of the country been willing to step into this and say that a partisan gerrymander is unconstitutional.
That standard, David Daly mentioned, there are researchers hard at work testing possibilities in a search for the best way to measure partisan gerrymandering. Here's one of them.
My name is Mira Bernstein. I am research faculty at Tufts University in the Program for Science, Technology, and Society.
And she's also
a member of the Metric Geometry and Gerrymandering Group.
The Metric Geometry and Gerrymandering Group. This is a gang of mathematicians in Boston. And we should note, the group's founder, Moon Dushan, is consulting on Pennsylvania's map with Governor Wolf. Now, Mira walked me through the standards we already have, at least the ones that have gotten the most attention. But first, there's something that she really wants you to know.
I think we should all stop thinking so much about shapes for two reasons. One is that crazy shapes can appear legitimately for legitimate reasons, because you're supposed to put communities of interest together and people don't always live in blobs. And conversely, because these days with modern technology and big data, politicians can make not so crazy shapes and still have very, very partisan effects.
Stop thinking about the shapes. What about the long tail in the 6th District of Pennsylvania or Goofy and Donald in the Pennsylvania 7th? Well, it's like the Matrix.
The Matrix is a system, Neo. That system is our enemy. But when you're inside, you look around, what do you see? Businessmen, teachers, lawyers, carpenters. The very minds of the people we are trying to save. But until we do, these people are still a part of that system, and that makes them our enemy. You have to understand, most of these people are not ready to be unplugged. And many of them are so inert, so hopelessly dependent on the system, that they will fight to protect it. Were you listening to me, Neo? Or were you looking at the woman in the red dress?
I was...
Look again.
Okay, so Mira is saying don't get distracted by the disturbing shapes of gerrymandered districts. To understand how modern gerrymandering really works, you have to see the code. It's all about the math. And if you look across the slate of court cases out there, three possible standards emerge. One.
The efficiency gap standard. In every election, votes are being wasted. So what the efficiency gap does is it says, let's look at the gap of the efficiency by which votes are translated to seats. In other words, the difference in how many votes are wasted. So count up all the Republican wasted votes in the state, whether by winning too much or by losing. Count up all the Democratic wasted votes in the state. Take the difference, so subtract them to compare them. And then just divide by the total number of votes in the state. That's the efficiency gap.
Standard number two.
Mean median. You take all your districts in the state, you line them up from least Republican to most Republican. You look at the percentages by which Republicans won those districts. You take the mean, so the average of those percentages. You take the median, which is the percentage in the middle district, and you subtract the mean from the median. Now, you might wonder, why would you want to do that? And it turns out that if you do some complicated math, not so complicated math, actually, what this actually translates to is by how much could the Republicans afford to lose the election and still win a majority of the representatives.
And finally,
the extreme outlier standard is a new standard. And for some reason, it's not at all been in the news, even though it's actually been used in the Wisconsin case, in the Pennsylvania case, in the North Carolina case. It's basically been one of the most convincing standards or arguments used. In the Wisconsin case, during oral arguments at the Supreme Court, the plaintiffs didn't bring it up. The justices brought it up. The justices wanted to talk about it because they found it so much more convincing than the efficiency gap arguments. So Breyer, Justice Breyer, outlined what he thought was a good standard, and it starts with intent.
Step one, the judge says, was there one party control of the redistricting? If the answer to that is no, say there was a bipartisan commission, end of case.
What they're really trying to do is to make sure they don't get a ton of court cases. So they want to try to rule out gerrymanders to start with.
Step two, is there partisan asymmetry? In other words, does the map treat the political parties differently? And a good evidence of that is a party that got 48% of the vote, got a majority of the legislature. Question three is there going to be persistent asymmetry over a range of votes? That is to say, one party A gets 48%, 49%, 50%, 51. That's sort of the S curve shows you that, you know, whether there is or is not. And there has to be some. And if there is, you say, is this an extreme outlier in respect to asymmetry?
Once you go down this route and you say, okay, like you can't explain this outcome by a few things, then the last step is, okay, now run those 20,000 maps.
And we looked through thousands and thousands of maps, and somebody did it with real maps.
And see if it's explained by the geography of your state.
And said, how bad is this compared to, you know, the worst in the country? And then if all those, the test flunks all those things, you say, is there any justification? Was there any other motive? Was there any other justification? Now, I suspect that that's manageable. I'm not positive.
And then, yeah, if you're in the bottom, you know, 1% of those maps or 0.5% or 5% or whatever threshold the Supreme Court chooses to set, if as a result of your maps, the other party lost 10% of the seats or 5% or whatever they set, that is my hope that that is the standard they will set. That standard doesn't measure gerrymandering according to some abstract ideal that is not actually achievable, but it measures it, compares it to what could have been done.
And the power of that extreme outlier standard, Mira says, is that it's reproducible and reliable. Once the court sets a standard, you can run any map a political majority might come up with against 10,000 simulations or 20,000 or 30,000 and shake out the outliers. The test has been run in Wisconsin and North Carolina and Pennsylvania. The result? All outliers. All gerrymandered. Mira calls Pennsylvania a no-doubter. The mathematicians and the computers they use might have an enormous democratizing power here.
I don't think we need to have this power. For example, there's a group called the Public Mapping Project that is trying to come up with open source redistricting software and all the necessary data by 2021 so that people can do their own redistricting. Educators or community activists can run redistricting competitions where people can do their own redistricting. And then, you know, when the legislature says, oh, here's the plan we came up with, you can say, oh, this student at this university came up with a plan that is so much better in every dimension, like, and challenge them and hold them accountable. Yes, the mathematicians and the technical people have power, but we actually want to use this to give it back to citizens. The thing is, though, that the citizens have to get politically active and, you know, actually use it and hold politicians accountable with it.
It's a travesty that somebody would do this. I mean, I am offended. I am angry and offended. That's why I said I had to do something. That's why I felt like I had to do something. I'm just angry and offended that somebody would do this to me. I feel it personally.
Back in Pennsylvania, Beth Lawn and voters like her are fed up and taking action.
My vote doesn't count. My representative picked me. I didn't pick my representative. I go into the voting booth, I see a Democratic candidate and a Republican candidate, and I vote for the Democratic candidate, and I know that person's not going to win. It's fixed. It's rigged. You know, we talk about this all the time, about how elections in these countries that aren't democratic are rigged. This is a rigged election right here in a country and a state that's supposed to be a democracy and go by the rules of a democracy, and it's a rigged election. My candidate can't win.
The districts are wrong. It is wrong to define a district to achieve a particular result. I don't care who is getting the benefit. That's not the right way to do it.
One way or another, Pennsylvania will have a new electoral map, and the Supreme Court should rule sometime this year to give states some guidelines. Will it be enough?
Even if the Supreme Court comes down with a meaningful remedy that reins in partisan gerrymandering, this decade has been lost. And I think that there is a sense that something has to be done to solve this problem. But the additional energy from this is going to have to come from Republicans who want to find a way back to common sense again. This is a fight for the country, but it's also a fight that Republicans have to join for the future of their political party.
As long as politicians have the power to draw our electoral maps, they're going to look for advantages. But where voters used to be excluded, now they don't have to be. New technology really can tell when a map is just a power grab. Mira Bernstein says in the future, why not use it openly, publicly? Put the map simulations on a big screen at the state capitol. Maybe, but the point is that it doesn't have to be this way anymore. And by the way, the mathematicians at the Metric Geometry and Gerrymandering Group produced more than 3 billion simulated maps testing the ones submitted by Pennsylvania Republicans to the court last week. The result? It's an extreme outlier. Gerrymandered. Again. With so much happening in Pennsylvania, we called Beth Lawn one last time to find out how she's feeling about what's ahead.
Hello.
Hi, Beth. There's just a few days left. How are you feeling?
Well, hello, Amber. I'm feeling really good. I'm feeling very hopeful, and I'm hoping now that this is going to be a new day for us in Pennsylvania, one that we'll celebrate, you know, in years to come when we look back on this and see that this was a time when we took back our power and we reestablished a political system in Pennsylvania based on fairness and equality, like the one that William Penn and all the first framers of the Constitution envisioned for us here in Pennsylvania. So I'm really, you know, looking forward to this. I'm looking forward to this as being a model for other people, too, in other states. You know, other states are struggling with some of these same issues that we are, and I'm just hoping that they'll see this as something that's empowering them as well and that we can all start working to restore people's faith in democracy.
This has been Drawn Out, a special podcast from The Takeaway. This episode was produced by Ellen Frankman and Amber Hall and mixed by Jake Howitt. The Takeaway's executive producer is Irva Gunja. I'm Todd Zwillick. See you next time.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.